This episode of the E-Commerce Playbook podcast is brought to you by Soral. Build your influencer marketing program on autopilot with a simple workflow for everything from gifting to paid campaigns. Try it out for free at getsoral.com/champions/CTC or with the link in the show notes. Hey folks, welcome to the E-Commerce Playbook podcast. I'm your host, Richard Gaffin, the Director of Digital Product here at Common Thread Collective. And I'm joined, as always, by CEO of Common Thread Collective, the Sultan of Scale himself, Mr. Taylor Holiday. Taylor, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Richard. It's funny. I was Dane Sanders, who's our VP of Employee Development and Performance here at CDC, was just slacking me. He's been talking to the ChatGPT bot and asking it for opinions of mine. And ChatGPT is now giving Taylor Holiday opinions as part of its thing. So he said, like, give me an e-commerce playbook in the tone of Taylor Holiday. And I've been reading it and I'm realizing that I'm not long for this world, Richard. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, soak me up while you can, because the AI version is coming and it's more thoughtful and more articulate than the real thing.
Yeah. Do you have a greatest hit?
Well, it's funny. Like, so one of the things he asked it was, let me see if I can pull this up exactly. Like, give me the 10 most controversial opinions that Taylor Holiday has about e-commerce. Right. And it's funny, the first one I actually is like profit over revenue. So it actually, like, I'm like, okay, I'm on board with that.
Oh, nice.
And then it goes into a bunch of things about, let's see, number two is build a brand, not just a store. Holiday believes that building a strong brand is essential for e-commerce success and that e-commerce businesses should focus on creating unique brand identity to differentiate themselves from competitors. So I'm like, all right, you know what, ChatGPT, you're listening. Thanks for the, maybe like, rate and review if you would. If you don't mind, ChatGPT, if you're listening.
That's right. You're right. Taylor Bot is coming your way soon. Cool, man. Well, so today we have a very, very special episode that we previewed a couple of weeks ago. And what we're presenting to you guys today, or what we're excited to announce, is our latest product from Common Thread Collective, and that is the e-commerce diagnostic toolkit. And the idea here is this takes all of our philosophy and distills it into essentially two things, right? A PDF that you'll download, essentially a white paper that kind of lays out the philosophy, the thought work behind this diagnostic, and then the diagnostic itself, which is a, I want to say like 25 question or something like that, assessment, where you enter in all of these metrics from your brand specifically. And at the end of it, the diagnostic spits out a very special number, a new metric that we're calling your GQ or growth quotient. And the idea behind the growth quotient is this is a way to assess the growth potential of your brand, not necessarily whether your brand is healthy or not, although there's some relationship there, but to what extent, or maybe I should say this, like, how ready is the fire to burn, right? How much rocket fuel is on it? So what I want to talk about today is not only the specifics of this product, but also, you know, a lot of this, as many things do, come from the mind of Taylor, the real Taylor, not Taylor Bot. And so we have Taylor here to kind of explain some of the thought behind it. So let's get started. Maybe this, it was adapted, I think, from a training that you would do with our growth strategist about when a new brand comes to us, what are the initial signals that we look at to assess whether or not there's potential for this brand to grow? And on one hand, to be a good client, but also to rapidly expand their operation. So maybe get into a little bit of your thought work behind kind of starting this out.
As an agency CEO, my primary responsibility, I believe, is to figure out how we are deploying institutional knowledge through every end node of the system. Okay. You get hired because of the 12 years of history that we have and everything we've learned along the way. But the reality is that knowledge isn't encapsulated in each individual. It's encapsulated in this sort of amorphous idea of the organization or the company. And so my job is to really actually quantify and operationalize that knowledge. And so one of the ways that I wanted to do that was to look over the history of CTC and try to identify a common set of attributes that exist amongst the brands that have been highly effective and have grown really well. That's our job. We're an e-commerce growth agency. And then to begin to teach people how they could search for those attributes. And when a new brand starts, a strategist's primary job is to assess the present landscape, to identify the gap between their present state and the future reality that they want to have, and then identify what they need to accomplish in order to achieve that outcome. And what I have found is that this diagnostic set, this set of things to look at, is a wonderful place to start to begin to identify the biggest hurdles to growth or the areas that are opportunities to accelerate growth. And so by teaching, coming up with a framework, and this is a very sort of McKinsey thought modeling idea that like there is no single answer. There's a framework of ideas that you can apply onto data and to sort out. You can get each person, regardless of their experience or how long they've been at CTC, to replicate the same set of evaluations criteria to get to a common identification of problems. Now, there's almost always a novel solution. There's directionally consistent solutions, but each solution is pretty novel, but the identification process of the problem is pretty consistent. And so this is what I set out to do to train our strategists. And then anytime I'm thinking about doing something at CTC, I want it to affect the full customer journey. So how does this turn into marketing collateral that helps the sales team, that helps the service team all the way through? And I think this product that we're building is exactly that. It's internal training and methodology meets marketing collateral, meets a way that we can help you in the sales process identify how we'll service you. And so I think it has a chance to be really, really impactful for both upskilling our employees and leveling people up and helping brands very quickly identify their own opportunities.
Right. I think like one of the ideas behind this is some of the way that I framed it in the introduction to the product itself. This idea that, to your point, like I think one of the some of the thought work behind the GQ score was the idea that there are a consistent set of things or set of problems that most businesses have. As you point out, the actual solutions themselves could be all kinds of different things, and they're different for every business. But in fact, like once we kind of put together like what this score looked like and figured out the ways that it was calculated, it became pretty clear, like, yeah, it's consistent with like the brands who are crushing it get high scores. The brands who are really struggling get low scores. It's just the way it goes. And it's just because there's about, according to this, we have about 10 things that you can struggle with and 10 places where you can have serious gaps. And the point behind this is like a lot of clients come to us, and you've seen this happen a number of times, and they're desperately trying to solve a problem that they don't really have. And I think that the classic example or kind of the dead horse we like to beat is the idea of ROAS being the problem, right? Our yep. Facebook performance isn't efficient enough. And they're doing everything they can to figure out how to fix that performance issue, when in actual fact, if they had gone through this diagnostic process, they would have learned that there were actually much different problems or deeper problems or more complex problems that they had to have a totally different set of tools to solve. So let's go into those 10 issues, or let's say opportunity areas, which we're calling the duckweed metrics. Now, this is a metaphor of yours, Taylor. So yeah. Why don't you share with us what a duckweed brand is and why you use this metaphor?
So for everyone listening, being a duckweed brand should be your aspiration, right? So when I was thinking about teaching this, I wanted to come up with a category of the really elite brands, right? Like what are the brands that are the best? And so I started looking into what is the fastest growing plant in the world. That was my initial Google search. And I started down this rabbit hole and I found duckweed. And so duckweed is the fastest growing plant on earth in terms of how quickly it can replicate and grow. And the reason is really fascinating. It was sort of like a perfect metaphorical setup, is that there are less cells inside of a duckweed plant that require light, which is the primary mechanism for photosynthesis in most plants, that require light to replicate. So duckweed can grow in the dark is a really fancy way of saying that. And so what it made me think about was, as we enter a macroeconomic environment, that is sort of the light and dark metaphor can represent a really positive tailwind macro environment, and the dark is sort of a resistant headwind environment. What is the plant? What is the brand that grows in any environment? That sort of, it is, and anti-fragile is another way of saying this, right? It's all in the same ethos of the things we're looking at all the time, which is that what is the brand that can grow in any environment? And so that's what I sort of coined, was duckweed brands are the fastest growing brands in the world because they can grow in any environment. They're not dependent on anything because they have this set of attributes about them that are inherent to the makeup of the business that make them incredibly good at growth. And so that's what we wanted to assign to Richard. I think we put it as like the top 10% of brands in this scale. I don't know the exact threshold. That gets you the duckweed label. And so every brand should be aspiring to become a duckweed brand. And then we should study very closely those brands that fall into this category. And over the next few weeks, we're going to have a few of them on this podcast to discuss what makes them so special. But that's the idea behind duckweed. It's the most elite scores in the GQ. And if you think about GQ as our comp for IQ, right? Intelligence quotient, we would call them geniuses, right? Like, so that the top, you know, 10% of IQ scores are what we would consider genius. Well, the top 10% of GQ scores are what we would consider duckweed brands or the fastest growing brands in the world.
Yeah. And we've sort of at least initially benchmarked the, like, the duckweed GQ score, the genius score at 130, which is of course the IQ score necessary to get into Mensa.
That's right.
And so, yeah, that's sort of the idea.
Mensa, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I, as a former English major who took a poetry class or two, like, the beauty of this metaphor is very satisfying because there's obviously its ability to grow at any time, but also this idea, that duckweed is also basically food for all of the creatures on a pond. So there's also this element too of, like, it creates nourishment or sustenance for all, like, the things around it. And brands that grow rapidly do have that effect on the people who work for them and sort of the environment around them. And then also, that idea that, like, there are specific attributes to the plant itself deep down, like on the DNA level, that cause it to be able to survive at all times. And that's exactly what we're looking for. These diagnostic attributes, these are the 10 genetic markers. If you picture, like, the Gattaca thing, right? GA, like the different pieces that make up your DNA strand. These are those pieces. So let's break down exactly what some of them are. I've divided these into two buckets, right? So bucket number one is the operational metrics. These are metrics that generally you will need to find on your own P&L that don't necessarily have to do specifically with marketing. And then the other half of the metrics, or rather I should say, seven of the metrics are marketing metrics, which are just specific to how are you distributing, how are you sending your message, where are you paying for attention, that kind of thing. So the three operational metrics, let's go through them each. We have, first off is, this is another Taylor original metric here, which is cost of delivery as a percentage of revenue. So Taylor, what is cost of delivery and why is it different than what everyone else is using right now?
Yeah, well, in a GAAP basis, everyone would refer to what they would call COGS, cost of goods sold. And that's sort of the general above the line gross margin calculation. And that's certainly important and useful and should be tracked on your P&L. But more interesting to me is every dollar that is required to get the product to the customer. And so we would refer to those as variable costs. They go up as orders go up. So we coined this term cost of delivery, which is the total cost to get the product from production all the way to the doorstep of a customer. And because every time you sell something, that's actually the cost that you incur. And so when we think about calculating contribution margin, we want to include every variable expense associated with that process. And so I want to look at that number as a percentage of your total revenue, more so even than I want to look at your cost of goods as a percentage of total revenue. Because cost of goods, in some cases, is actually a smaller line item than the shipping cost itself, right? Depending on the value to weight ratio of the product. And so we just have to include every transaction fee, every fulfillment expense, every shipping expense, and the actual cost of production of the product, get a sense of how much money we make every time we sell something.
Yep. Right. So it's, to put simply, it's just any cost that scales with sales, right?
If the order number goes up, the cost goes up. That's right.
Yeah. Right. And then, so actually maybe you could point out, what expenses are maybe classically thought of as fixed cost or OPEX that we are actually including in cost of delivery?
Well, so I think that shipping is certainly one of them, but the other, like, merchant processing fees on a P&L, you'll absolutely see that in G&A, right? You're not going to see that above the line looking at gross margin, but for me, like, it is a direct percentage of every order that you're paying on, right? So I think that's a very obvious one. Another one is the fulfillment expense. So, like, if your 3PL charges you a pick fee, so $1 per order as a pick fee, that's going to show up as an invoice that you pay to your vendor, right? And again, because of the way it gets paid and accounted for and sort of set up, it doesn't get tracked on that, like, per order basis. It's like, at the end of the month, here's your invoice. You pay the invoice that shows up in your G&A as a vendor payment. But in reality, what you're being charged is every time an order comes in, you do a pick, you get charged on that. And so it should be a consideration in the cost when you're calculating contribution margin.
And so we've set kind of as the benchmark for the duckweed brand is 30% or less of total revenue. So on the flip side,
which
then,
is a hard, I'm just going to, I just want to say, like, that's a, that's a high bar, right? Like, but that's important to understand is that when we're talking about Mensa here, we're talking about duckweed, we're talking about the elite of the elite in the ability to drive efficient value capture. And go listen to Bernard Arnault on talk about LVMH and why it's such a great business. It's because they drive massive margin capture on the value of the product, right? Like that is what happens in elite brands. They have pricing leverage against their costs in a way that produces meaningful profit. So it's a high bar, right? But we know it.
Yeah. And right, maybe this is a good point to, or a good time to point out that if you are missing on a specific metric, that may not necessarily be the end of the discussion for you being a duckweed brand, because if you're absolutely crushing it on another one, you may be able to balance that out. So there are brands that we have that are duckweed brands for sure that aren't hitting this particular metric, because it is a difficult one to hit, but they make up for it in other ways. It's just a good point of like, yeah, there's no having a good or bad score here isn't necessarily like going to kill your business or make it successful. There are a lot of other kind of factors that play into it as well. So the flip side of cost of delivery is, of course, OPEX as a percentage of revenue. And I guess there's maybe not much to say here other than there are certain costs that are maybe classically thought of as not OPEX that we do include as OPEX, because it's any fixed cost or any cost that does not scale with volume of production. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything to elaborate on there really.
Say that more and more, if there's any metric I'm thinking of like pushing down further in terms of what the baseline expectation is, it's this one. We're entering a world where like labor costs in many categories are being driven down to zero and the volume output is being driven to infinity, right? Like that's what AI does, is that it takes these production costs around things like design and copywriting and other production element tasks and drives the cost down to zero. And so more and more great organizations are going to get incredible labor leverage. And I think that that's going to be something that you're going to see a lot more of, is that payroll is going to be driven from, I think it's like an 8 to 12% average in most brands down to 4 to 6. And that's just going to continue to create margin expansion opportunities.
Yeah. And I think like this may be of all of the metrics we have here missing on this one, maybe the most red flaggy, I would say, because currently I think we have our benchmark set at 25%, and a lot of brands are actually able to clear that. Like they've gotten their costs to a place where they're not, where it's less than 25%, which is great. But as you point out, like that, those numbers are going to need to come down more and more to be able to compete. And if you're over that in this environment, you're not in a great spot. And that's something to figure out urgently, I think. Okay. So a third operational metric is one that I think maybe could use a little bit of unpacking here, and that's cash conversion cycle. And so the idea here is like, this is essentially the number of days that you have to float inventory costs. Now, obviously for some like big ticket items, that's going to be a really long time, like furniture or whatever, cars or something. But for other brands, like the ideal is to get to a place where the cash conversion cycle is negative. So maybe Taylor, you can talk us through what is cash conversion cycle, and then what are the individual elements that go into it that can affect this number?
E-commerce businesses, the hardest thing about them is how cash intensive they can be if the terms of this aren't correct. So cash conversion cycle refers to the process of taking cash, buying inventory, receiving that inventory, and turning it back into cash through sales. That's simply what it is, right? It's the process of taking your cash, turning it into product, and then back into more cash. And so the question is often, how much of a gap is there in the outlay of your capital? So when you pay for the goods, how long do you wait before it turns back into cash, and ideally more cash than you started with, right? And the best brands, when we say a negative cash conversion cycle, what we mean is that you actually can order the product, receive the product, sell it, and pay for it with the proceeds of the sale so that you actually never have an outlay of capital, right? Now, that's incredibly hard to do because it requires that you have incredible terms with your supplier, such that they're usually willing to allow you to pay them 30 to 90 days after receipt of the product. Most brands, when they start out early on, they have very little leverage with their supplier, and they're paying for all their product up front, which means, let's say it takes 12 weeks to produce something, I pay for it. I'm now out cash 12 weeks before I can even try and sell it. And then it takes me another 30, 60, 90 days, whatever, to sell it. And so that total cycle before I get my money back is really, really long. Well, that means I have a deficit in my bank account, very simply. And I have to figure out how to cover that deficit to cover all the other expenses that the business needs to operate. So the longer that deficit is, the more at risk the business comes of suffering death really is the problem, is that cash is the ultimately the lifeblood of the business. And so now there's all sorts of solutions for this related to inventory financing and other capital and financing vehicles. And so part of this consideration, if I were to dive deeper into just what is the cash conversion cycle, would be what debt facilities you have available to you and what other financial engineering and sourcing can you pull. But as an initial glance, understanding your cash conversion cycle understands the amount of inventory purchasing power somebody can have, which is a huge factor in growth. Because if you can buy excess inventory, tons of it, you can fuel growth when it happens. A lot of times what I saw in COVID was that growth was constrained for people based on their ability to buy enough product. Because they had to outlay so much cash, they couldn't even capture the demand when it existed. And so a Duckweed brand never misses the moment because they have inventory purchasing leverage all the time. And so their risk in buying inventory is really low, and it doesn't create depletion of their cash reserves. And so they can seize every moment all the time.
We talk a lot about good and bad UGC, but if you want a streamlined way to do the good kind of UGC, which is product seeding, then look no further than Soral. If you're still using a spreadsheet to save creator profiles for influencer management, you will love this Chrome extension that comes with Soral. You can see engagement rates, like projections, and their fair price without even leaving their profile. And you can add them to your creator CRM with one click. And that's just step one. You can search for influencers, send personalized outreach emails, manage your relationships, and track performance all in one place. Sound too good to be true? See for yourself with Soral's free trial. Just go to getsoral.com/champions/CTC or click the link in the show notes. Yeah, so let's move on to the marketing metrics then. So if those three operational metrics are just sort of about maybe the fundamentals of your business and how it operates, these are more about what we do, let's say at CTC, and what we can do for you. And so this, I should say too, like this is a combination of some of the anti-fragile metrics that we talked about, was that last year or 2 years ago? And some of the metrics that are included in the actual strategist training. So the marketing metrics can be broken down, I would say, into maybe three different buckets or four. And so the first one is just around your 60-day LTV. And there's four metrics that really play into that or sort of are in conversation with that, I suppose. And so first is 60-day incremental revenue growth percentage. This is, you know, what is the percentage gain in revenue between first purchase, and then in 60 days, right? 1 year incremental revenue growth percentage, which is the same metric, but over the course of a year. And the benchmarks for those two are 30% growth for 60 days and then 100% growth for 1 year. And then we also want to calculate this in terms of ratio, right? Which is, so two comparisons here. One is first order value to new customer acquisition cost ratio, right? Which is what is the ratio of your AOV basically to the CAC of getting that customer. And then the 1 year LTV to new customer acquisition cost ratio. CAC stays the same, but revenue grows. What does that look like a year from now? So Taylor, maybe break down this kind of like complex of metrics and talk to us a little bit about how this works for a Duckweed brand.
Very simply stated, a Duckweed brand profitably acquires new customers on their first order, and those customers meaningfully increase in value over the subsequent 30, 60, 90 days all the way up through infinity, right? So Duckweed brands efficiently acquire customers and those customers increase in value significantly over time. That's like the simplest way to say that. And so now to quantify it, we want to look at a few different things. So the LTV, is a metric we've talked a lot about how it's got a deficiency in that it references a variable time period. And so what we want to look at is the actual sort of very specified time periods of growth. So we look at 60 days and why 60 days? Well, it's an immediate window. And there's two interesting things about LTV for most brands. For most brands, the majority, more than 50% of the value capture of the lifetime value of the customer happens within 60 days of purchase. This is not intuitive. Like now, the longer the business exists, the lower that percentage can go down, but a lot of the subsequent value happens very shortly after purchase, right? And so we want to see not just does a brand have the ability to produce value over a very long period of time, but how quickly do they produce additional value? This has a real impact on your cash flow. We call this the cash multiplier for that reason. How fast do you increase the value of your customers? So it's not just how much, but also the velocity of it really matters. And then we want to pair that with a longer view. So 1 year. So we want to look at both 60 days and over a year. We want to make sure that it isn't just a sort of offer trick that you've created where you did free shipping or free product plus shipping, and then you sold them something. And so it looks like there's a big LTV increase over 60 days, but it just flattens out from there and doesn't go up. Mm-hmm. So great brands, they have this curve that for 60 days, it's going up, but it continues up through the next 12 months, 24 months, 36 months for all time. And so both of those things are really great indicators. And we've found a very clear benchmark that the best brands have a 30% increase in 60 days and 100% in a year. And so that's like a great indication of it. And then from there, FOV over NCAC is just a question of first order profitability. So we would, when I always say first order value, we would put value in this case in brackets. And we use that as a symbol to say net value. So actual contribution divided by NCAC, basically, to say that, are you making a profitable dollar on your first new customer? Because this is really important. We go back to cash conversion cycle. We go back to the ability to order inventory. We go back to the latency of value capture. The best brands produce first order profit. And that's sort of a gold standard today more than ever before, because the cost of capital is high, because this idea of fueling unprofitable growth is sort of deteriorated left. You've got to be first order profitable. And that's basically what you're assessing. And then if you think about that, if you have first order profitability and you have 100% increase in value in a year, then when we look at this next metric, which is the 1 year LTV to new customer acquisition cost, which is another thing we'll often talk about is ROIC, return on invested capital, which would be net operating profit divided by investment, right? So if we think about in that case, 1 year LTV in the same way, V value bracketed net value, so contribution in 1 year over the cost to acquire a customer, net operating profit over investment. What that means, if you're first order profitable and your customer increases 100% in a year, you have an ATM machine. You have an investment vehicle that generates at least 100% return on invested capital in a year. Like, that is the kind of thing that you should be pouring dollars into, and brands do, which is why they're duckweed brands, because they grow really, really fast when those economics exist inside of the business.
Yeah. So this is actually maybe like a good example or a good place to point out like the way that all of these metrics relate to one another and how being deficient in one isn't necessarily an issue per se if you're killing it in the other ones, right? So one thing that we talk about a lot, and maybe this is something you can break down for us here, is as you grow and as you expand, that number, the first order value to new NCAC ratio, is going to kind of approach zero, right? Like being net profitable on that first sale is going to get lower and lower. And ultimately, that can be an indicator of a good thing, which is that your brand is growing and you're, let's say, more well-capitalized, you're more able to float those costs. And the best scenario is that 30% gain in LTV or greater over 60 days is enough to make sure that you break even on that first sale. So maybe talk about that relationship a little bit.
Yeah. So I think that you want to continue to aggressively fund every dollar that produces a return in excess of your hurdle rate, whatever that is as a business. And I think that's got to have a consideration for the cost of capital. That's got to have a consideration for your current capitalization. And let's just say that that's 50%. Like, you should be pressing every dollar up until that 50% threshold is hit. And that likely means that you're going to press right up against first order profitability if you have a good LTV, right? Because again, remember, if you're returning 30% within 60 days, even if you break even on the first order, you are making a lot of money. So there is almost no reason not to fund that acquisition. Right. Now, the only reason you wouldn't fund it is if because you're attempting to achieve some sort of short-term profitability outcome. But otherwise, people should continue to press up until that marginal threshold. We would call it the marginal frontier. Right? This is a term that Jason Bornstein, who's been on this product or podcast with me before from 4Runner Ventures, uses, which is that's the moment at which you are no longer producing any incremental profit on first order. Like, that line somewhere out there in your spend matrixy is that threshold, and you want to press against it. And most good brands do. A great example, if you listen to the president from True Classic Teas, who was on a Moiz Ali podcast, like, he talks about this, right? Like, they are looking for every mechanism to press up against this threshold to go as fast as they can. Because the other thing about these channels is they don't last forever. When you have a mechanism for generating that kind of return on a customer, you should insatiably take it. Right? Like, you should go as fast as you can because it doesn't last forever. But when the unit economics are right, grab as much as you can. Now, the brands that can do that, they have the cash conversion cycle, they have the inventory leverage, they have the capitalization, they have all the things to do that. So these are all not just the attributes, but the behaviors that you see inside of these duckweed brands is that they insatiably grab profitable customer acquisition and throttle until they can't anymore.
Yeah, this is just maybe a good way of saying, like, even if you're missing, let's say, on this one, the solution to it isn't necessarily going to be like, let's try to figure out how to make ourselves as efficient on first order value capture as possible.
No.
Because that's not necessarily the solution. Although our most duckweed brand that we've put through this process so far, which has a GQ over 1,000, are outrageously profitable on the first order value, and outrageously the growth of their LTV is unbelievable, over 30%. So
that's right.
If you can have all of these in a great place, that's of course the better scenario. But it's unusual to be in a situation like that where they appear anyway to be having difficulty even getting to that break-even threshold because their CAC to FOV ratio is so crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, there are these anomalies like that. But even in that scenario, I would contend, and their founder and I, we talk about this, is that like the problem probably is that they're not pressing hard enough. That's the mistake, yeah, behaviorally, is that there's actually more available to them than they realize, despite like their organizational obligations being monthly percentage growth every single month. Like that's the measure of success inside of that. Whereas most of us are like, if we could get year over year 8%, we'd be happy. They're like every month, 8 to 10%, you know? So it's just different attributes provide different opportunities.
Yeah. And we'll hopefully talk to the founder in a couple of weeks, because it's a really fascinating case study. And I think just sort of pointing out how this GQ metric can be so indicative of your potential, and then how like the solutions to capitalizing on that opportunity can be so different for so many different brands. Okay, so let's move on to like the sort of last three metrics. I would kind of think of these together, even though like they're not really that interrelated. But so first off is like the number of distribution channels. And this is a holdover from our anti-fragile scorecard. It's this idea of like, basically, where are you selling and do you have too many eggs in one basket? So maybe talk a little bit about that and the way that people can kind of go wrong with distribution channels.
Yeah. So again, there's always this tension between just like trying to make the numbers on this thing go up just for the sake of the numbers. But so just having distribution that sort of conflicts with itself. So like if you were to say, I have my online store and then I have a bunch of other online retailers that only sell online and only capture and slice my existing demand, the value is not nearly as meaningful as if you have real distribution in, let's say, retail or a B2B channel that is purely incremental to the work that you're already doing. But the reality is that the more points of distribution that you have, the more opportunity for demand capture for the work that you do to create demand exists. We're still in a world where 15% of e-commerce or 15% of retail transactions happen online and 85% don't, right? And of course, that's category specific and it's different in different categories, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that most of the demand capture still happens offline. And so if you're going to be a brand that is going to do the work of realizing all of your efforts in marketing, you're going to be able to meet the customer in more than one location. And I was listening to Bill D'Alessandro on a podcast yesterday and he put out a tweet today too, just saying like, D2C is not a business model. It's a channel. Like, and I think that's what we're all sort of realizing and coming to terms with, is that our job is to meet the customer everywhere they are. And the customers a lot aren't just on our website. And so I think we have to think about creating channel diversification that offsets the risk of depletion in any channel as well. Now there's different sets of risks with each of the alternative channels. But the reality is that there's value to be had in having more points of distribution as a business.
Right. What are some of the distribution channels that maybe you don't think of, or what are like, there's opportunity that maybe it's not just like, oh, get your product in Target. Like what are some of the distribution?
So yeah, retail or wholesale is the sort of obvious one, right? Like that's what you're talking about. And there's sort of a whole set of those, from independent retailers to small chain stores to the big, you know, mass market chains that you just mentioned there, the Targets and the Walmarts, that are the sort of the obvious part of channel distribution. I think one of the more powerful ones that's often underappreciated is what I would refer to as B2B sales. Think of this as like, when we were at Kalo, we would sell to the government for police and firefighters, or we would sell to safety, like OSHA safety standards for people working in assembly lines, right? Where the product becomes sort of mandatory issue gear for some worker in some environment. Like those are really powerful channels if you can get into B2B. Another one would be like corporate gifting, where your product becomes a gift that's given at Christmas to all the employees of a company and they're bulk buying thousands of units at a time, right? So those are additional channels of distribution that are generally really high leverage, really good partners if you can tap into them and are often sort of afterthought in many cases.
Cool. So let's talk then about our last two here. So the first is your percentage of organic traffic. And this is pretty straightforward. What percentage of traffic to your website comes from organic non-paid channels, maybe specifically? I think the flip side of this, or the way that people tend to fail on this metric, is being over-leveraged on paid, right?
That's right.
The classic, your brand sells maybe one or two things and you're building, all of your growth comes via Facebook, which is ultimately volatile. So let's talk a little bit maybe about how this, I think like it sort of relates to the revenue layer cake concept, I think, right?
Yep.
Is that your the stable sort of base of growth needs to be organic channels in order for you to be able to safely fuel that fire with paid acquisition, right?
It's very buzzwordy right now to say that brands want channel diversification in their media or in their traffic mix. And what they usually say is like, we want another paid channel where we can go put paid dollars that will perform like Facebook and Google.
Totally. Yeah.
But real channel diversification is a power of having an organic lever. And that usually comes from one of two things. Either you are an influencer that has an audience in some channel that you can siphon the audience attention there into your website. This is why creator brands are such a big thing that have real leverage over a lot of the non-audience brands, right? Or alternatively, maybe you have a really great SEO position in some keyword that generates a bunch of value over time for your business in a way that gives you a constant source of organic traffic outside something that you have to pay for. Right. And these things. And then the third one is like you have an organic flywheel that's inherent to your business. And so I use APL as a reference for this, one of our partners a lot, where the beautiful nature of their product and the customer that they sell it to leads to their customers posting on social a ton about their product in a non-paid way because it's beautiful and they want to show off that they wear it. Right. And that leads to people seeing the posts and coming back and driving organic demand in this like sort of virtuous cycle. And so those three things make it so that you get this sort of viral coefficient effect where every customer that you acquire has this ability to bring with them more future customers in an organic unpaid way. And so the value capture of your paid acquisition is actually greater than what shows up on a direct LTV to CAC calculation, because there's also this referral inference that's unmeasured that is real and generating future value as well.
Yeah. Another fantastic example would be our client Born Primitive as well, who at the point that they came to us, I believe they hadn't spent any money on paid media. I believe it had been all organic growth, which also another sort of example of just product market fit being the best advertising in a lot of ways. They make sports bras that fit women who do have CrossFit bodies, which is really unusual. You show up to the gym in one of those, people are like, oh my God, where can I get that? I'm tired of pinching when I do Olympic lifts or whatever. And bam, you get that sort of expansion on the organic level, which then our job becomes, again, the fire is already built. All we have to do is dump a little lighter fluid on top.
Yeah, that's
exactly
right.
And that's just
sort
of the beauty of having a organic traffic percentage over 50.
Yep.
So, okay. And then finally, number of revenue peaks. This is another sort of CTC original, this idea of the four peaks calendar, having four moments throughout your marketing calendar where revenue peaks a certain level over the mean. So let's talk a little bit about this. I know we've already, there's a lot of material out there about the four peaks theory, but I think it's maybe important to unpack here that we're talking about. So we are defining revenue peak as any month of the year that where revenue is 25% over the mean of non-holiday revenue, which is to say taking January through October, the mean of that 25% over that, any month January through December that beats that number is a revenue peak.
That's right.
And the idea here is that, of course, classically, a lot of people peak once or technically twice in November and December. And there's a lot of opportunity to find places to peak that revenue, seasonal drops, whatever. And I think really this is ultimately about the fact that a lot of brands don't really have a marketing calendar that's planned out any further in advance than a couple of months. So I don't know, Taylor, is there anything you want to unpack on that?
Well, it's just, this is a hat tip to people who plan well and who understand how to think about how product releases and product development fits into the process of becoming a great brand. But you could almost make an argument that this one goes into the operational part of the consideration here more than even the marketing, right? Where it is to say that like, these are people who plan great campaigns, they plan product releases, they plan moments, and they invest in developing moments where they have over indexed on the quality of work that they're doing, such that you can't every day produce wonderfully beautiful work that's deeply thoughtful, deeply planned, and broadly distributed. It just doesn't work that way. But you can do it at multiple points throughout the year. And the best brands do this. They sync together between product development and marketing in ways that one of the best ways, we talk about this a lot, to arbitrage advertising is to create unexpected increases in your estimated conversion or your conversion rate against your estimated conversion rate. If Facebook's out there bidding at a certain price against an expected conversion rate all the time, and then suddenly your site conversion rate spikes, you're going to be able to drive that bid price up, get more volume, capture more demand, get more new customer expectation. And while, you know, CRO is sort of this evergreen attempt at driving mall gains, these kinds of moments, limited edition products, campaign releases, influencer partnerships, et cetera, they can create these moments of peaking in your conversion rate that drive increased volume of new customer acquisition. It's why if you go look for almost any brand in the world, their largest day, single day of new customer acquisition for the entire year is Black Friday. And so it's just sort of taking that premise and saying, okay, how do I replicate what's happening there in more moments throughout the year to drive the best total outcome I can?
Yeah. So that wraps up the 10 duckweed metrics. These are the 10 genetic attributes of a duckweed brand. And what we want to know is, how do you fit into this, right? For all our listeners out there, what is your growth quotient? And I think this is going to be a super, super valuable tool to identify exactly the places where you can begin to think about taking advantage of your biggest opportunities to grow as fast as you possibly can.
Here's the thing I'll say, Richard, just real fast with this. Like, I believe that this has the potential that if you have a head of growth or if you have a chief growth officer, like this could be their KPI, is to make this number get better. Like, because there are so many things inherent in this attribute that it gives you a really clean measurement of all the work you're doing to make your brand more ready for growth. And so same thing as an agency, like you could use this to say, here's how we've made you better. Here's how we've improved your business. Because one of the tensions in even financial metrics, like in the usage margin in a 30-day window, is it doesn't necessarily tell you whether or not your future growth is set up well, right? It's always hard to balance the short-term long. Yeah. But alongside creating financial outcomes, the health of the vehicle, the overall performance of the business and its overall viability is encapsulated really well in your GQ. And so if you were sort of regularly taking your GQ once a quarter to see what have we done to improve this, that goal and KPIing somebody against it, I think would be a highly effective way to manage your internal team.
Yeah. And that's a great call out too, because I think like it's tempting, and we've sort of set it up this way that there is a benchmark 130, like that's the sort of duckweed benchmark. Above that, you're in a great place. Below that, you have some stuff to work on, whatever. But also theoretically, there's no upper limit to this. There's also no lower limit. But I think the idea of like using this as a benchmark for yourself against which you can grow is probably the most effective way to use it. Because yeah, any improvement in any one of these things is going to ultimately be good. And I think that this number, your GQ, and the results of this assessment are as close, I think, as we have of like a unified theory of sort of CTC.
That's right.
And all of the things that we think about, a unified theory of e-com even, all of the metrics, all of the variables that go into it brought into one place and turned into a single number that you can affect meaningfully on a day-to-day basis. We're stoked to put this out. Taylor, you got any final thoughts for us?
No, I want you, part of this is like one of the things that I want to take pride in doing is that we want to put a model out. We want to get feedback against the model. And we want to continue to refine it over time. We've got V2 of the enterprise scaling guide coming out here soon. That's going to be like an even better version of the forecasting model and the way that we build that. The same thing we want to do here. So if you take it and you feel like it doesn't reflect you, or there's some metric that you think we're missing and not considering, give us that feedback. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep improving GQ over time and the way that we assess it to make it a better and better score. We want to build a database of brands of the scores that they have to be able to, and then run correlation against their growth rate and overall profitability to really hold ourselves accountable to producing something that's useful in the market. So please participate in this research with us, and we'll do our best to continue to make it as valuable as we can for you.
Hey folks, thanks for listening to the E-commerce Playbook podcast. We're so excited to share the diagnostic toolkit with the community. And that's why right now, through Wednesday, May the 3rd, we're offering special early bird pricing to the CTC community, which includes you, our podcast listeners. All you have to do is go to commonthreadco.com/product/e-commerce-diagnostic, or it would probably be easier to just follow the link in the show notes. There's no discount code required to get the special pricing. Just click through, you'll get the pricing, you'll be good to go. So we hope to see you on the other side of the assessment. We're really stoked about it. And until next week, happy scaling, everyone.